Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome back to the Lowy Institute. I'm Michael Fullilove, the director of the Institute, and welcome to this special event, an in conversation with the recently retired Secretary of the Department of Defence, Dennis Richardson, AO. Let me begin by warmly welcoming Dennis and, of course, Betty back to the Institute. Ladies and gentlemen, Dennis Richardson was born in Kempsey in New South Wales, but grew up in Albury. He graduated from Sydney University in 1969 with a BA honours. And the same year, he joined the Department of External Affairs in the famed class of 1969. From 1969 to 86, he was in the Foreign Service, including postings to Nairobi, Moresby, and Jakarta. He also worked at the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet, and he was Prime Minister Hawke's Chief of Staff in the early 1990s. In 1996, he was appointed Director General of ASIO, where he served for nearly a decade. In 2005, he became Australia's ambassador to the United States. Dennis described his transition from ASIO to the Washington job in his typically laconic fashion, saying, "In this job, I'm paid to be nice to people. In my last job, I wasn't." In 2010, Dennis returned to Australia to serve as the Secretary of the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade. And from 2012, to until a couple of months ago, he was Secretary of the Department of Defence. Pretty impressive. During a remarkable half century of public service, serving, we think, if our calculations are correct, a dozen prime ministers, Dennis became one of the most widely respected public servants in Australia's history. He earned the trust of both sides of politics, and he built a reputation as a fierce defender of Australia's national interests, as well as the prerogatives of the public service. As he says, he hasn't worked for a prime minister or a minister with whom he hasn't had a fight. And that kind of approach no doubt serves him well in his position as board member of his beloved Canberra Raiders. So, ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Dennis Richardson. I'm going to ask Dennis questions for about 20 minutes or half an hour, and then I'm going to go to the audience. So I want to give everybody, or as many people as I can, an opportunity to ask a question. So please start thinking now. Dennis, let me conduct a bit of a tour of the horizon, if I can. To begin with, I guess, over much of your career, you're working very closely with politicians. What do you think about Australia's politicians? Are they as bad as everybody assumes? Are they better? Do they get a bad rap? Who are the politicians you most enjoyed working with? Who are the politicians you were most impressed
with? Well, first of all, they get a bad rap because they give one another a bad rap. They should say more nice things about one another. They work extraordinarily hard. I would defy anyone to keep up the pace of a prime minister. The demands on a prime minister's life are unreal. The demands on ministers are unreal. And I think, by and large, we've been well served by our political leaders. Look, I've enjoyed working with a lot. All the prime ministers I've worked closely with, from Prime Minister Bob Hawke on, different personalities, different strengths and the like, but they're all people who you would respect. I worked with two ministers, two people as ministers in more than one portfolio. I worked with Philip Ruddock in immigration and in ASIO, and I worked with Stephen Smith in foreign affairs and defence. Working with a prime minister and working with a minister is no different to trying to work things through in your own family. You know, if you want to get your spouse or partner to move in a particular direction, do you do it in the morning? Do you do it in the evening? Do you take them out to lunch? Do you do it while you're driving around the suburbs? You've got to know your person and you've got to pick your time. Mm-hmm. And that's the same in seeking to influence the outcome that you think is right.
What about the other party in that relationship, the Australian Public Service? You served in the APS, I think, for 48 years. How has the public service changed in that period? Have the changes been mainly for good or for ill, do you think?
It's difficult to know because, see, we all make comparisons, but If I make comparisons with the public service I joined, I'm making comparisons between a public service that I was working in looking up and a public service that I left where others were looking up. And it's difficult to distinguish a reality from fantasy in that sense, but certainly it's less formal than what it was. That's self-evident. The community at large is less formal. I think it's become more politically correct, and I mean that in both good and bad. I'm not a fan of political correctness. Communication has changed enormously, just the speed of communication, and the onset over the last dozen years of social media has added another dimension to all of that. So it is a very different place. I sometimes wonder whether the time has not come for a second Coombs Commission in terms of the public sector. We had a Royal Commission into the public service in the 1970s. And I think every so often institutions need to go back to their philosophical foundations, and I sometimes wonder whether the time has not come for a second Royal Commission, because community attitudes and standards have changed. The way in which ministers, ministerial advisors and public servants work together has completely changed. And I wonder whether we should not be revisiting the physical foundations of that, the philosophical foundations of that.
Well, one change that has been announced today on a much smaller scale is the formation of a super department, a Home Affairs department that includes your old shop, ASIO, as well as the Federal Police and Immigration, the Border Force and other agencies. There's been a lot of argument about whether this is a good thing or a bad thing. What do you think?
I'm fairly agnostic in respect of that. I think it's difficult to criticise. Equally, I think it's difficult to proclaim it as some great advance forward. We all forget that up until the election of 2013, ASIO, the AFP, AUSTRAC, the Crime Commission, and Customs were all in the one portfolio. They were all in the Attorney General's portfolio. We forget that. What is being added in Home Affairs is immigration. And there are probably some marginal benefits to be gained with immigration and the intelligence communities and law enforcement working closer together. But we do need to bear in mind a couple of things. First of all, in respect of ASIO and the AFP, we're talking about statutory organisations. And the AFP and ASIO has been in the one portfolio now for well over 20 years. So you're not doing anything new in respect of ASIO and the AFP working more closely together. Clearly, the special powers that ASIO has means that it must be accountable to an elected official, not to an unelected official. And if you were to seek to give the secretary of the new department some authority in respect of the AFP and ASIO and the like, I think you'd have to change legislation, and secondly, you'd have to ask yourself, is that an appropriate role for an unelected official to have? The final thing I would say on it is that we're a little bit different to a number of jurisdictions in liberal democracies. The power for ASIO to exercise its covert activity is but one exception, approved by the responsible minister. That responsible minister has always been the first law officer of the land in the Attorney General. If the Minister for Home Affairs is now to authorise ASIO warrants, it will mean for the first time we will have someone other than the first law officer of the land approving ASIO's covert activity. And I think there are ways and means you can effectively manage that, but I think that is a more serious issue than merely putting everything together in what's called a super portfolio.
So in terms of that last bit, putting all these organisations in a super portfolio, you began your answer by saying it's hard to criticise it, but it's hard to feel passionately in favour of it as well. Does that mean you think it's mainly presentational?
I think there is a reasonable argument in respect of immigration and bringing immigration closely together, but I think beyond that, it is primarily presentational.
Let me take you beyond.
And I would not criticise it for that reason. I would simply note that.
Let me look beyond Australia's shores and ask you some questions about the world. You compared Australia to other liberal democracies. I think all of us have observed that something has changed in the international system in the last couple of years, and that is that instability seems to be coming as often from liberal democracies as from illiberal countries. How would you reflect on what's happening to the West globally? Are the greatest threats, in a way, to the West becoming internal threats rather than external threats?
Well, certainly I think the global financial crisis of 2008-09 and the subsequent rise of populism in liberal democracies has given rise to, I think, a degree of uncertainty and anxiety emanating from within liberal democracies of a kind which for the last 70 years we have not had to turn our mind to. And we are not used to, when liberal democracies get together, they're used to talking about other countries outside of that philosophical framework, whether it be Russia, China, or whatever. I think increasingly liberal democracies, when they get together, are going to have to break the third party rule and start to talk behind the backs of their best mates.
Now, the politician, the world leader who's probably most skilled at taking advantage of the anxieties that you mentioned is Donald Trump, who has came to office against all expectations by trading on a lot of these emotions. And a lot of his policies, both domestic policies and external policies, are very illiberal in the sense in trade, in terms of alliances, his somewhat odd affinity to illiberal leaders like Vladimir Putin. You served as ambassador in the United States. You've seen lots of American politicians. How far out of the mainstream of American presidents do you think Donald Trump is? How much of a concern should his election and his policies be for a US ally like Australia?
We need to take a deep breath. Secondly, we need to avoid getting caught up in the poison of US domestic politics. Thirdly, I think it's important for us to read about the United States from different perspectives, and there is a bit of a tendency for parts of the media to get most of its perspective from one part of the US and US media. I was watching yesterday, I flicked between CNN and Fox. I was interested in the most recent Washington ABC poll, which showed President Trump at record lows. What Fox was running with was the fact that in all the counties which Trump won in the recent presidential election, across all those counties, he remains ahead 50 to 46. So you really do need to, I think, spread your source of information about the US. I think it's important, I've said it publicly previously, I think the bottom line is you do not allow the alliance, you do not allow the relationship to be hostage to one person's personality.
What do you make of the criticisms of some commentators that Australia needs more independence in its foreign policy, that we have an insufficiently independent foreign policy, we're too reliant on what the United States does?
Well, Alan Gingell, one of your predecessors here, who recently wrote a book, Fear of Abandonment, the history of Australian foreign policy from 1942 to the present, he would argue, and I agree with him, that Australia's foreign policy has always been independent. We have made our own decisions. And certainly, I believe that very strongly. We can be sometimes heavily influenced by the US, but the governments I've worked with have normally been pretty hard-headed in what they do and why they do it.
How would you characterise Australian foreign policy at the moment? I mean, we're all aware, we're all waiting on the new foreign policy white paper. Of course, you oversaw, I think, a couple of defence white papers. Do you think Australian foreign policy, the ambition of Australian foreign policy at the moment is sufficient for the international circumstances that we confront? Yeah. It often seems to me that Australia over the years, and Alan's book talks about a lot of these points, has been involved, Australia's really been involved in significant initiatives to try to shape our external circumstances, whether it was ANZUS or APEC or other kinds of issues. And I sometimes wonder what are the shaping initiatives that Australia is involved in at the moment, as opposed to very professionally dealing with the crises that come across our desk. Is there a need for Australian foreign policy to step up at all, or do you think that it's hitting the mark?
Well, certainly, I think there's never been a time where we have needed to have a premium on our own sense of our own national interests. I think we need to have a very sharp appreciation of that, and we certainly need to pursue that vigorously. I think in terms of the region, you can intensify what you're doing, but it's difficult to see what we could be doing that is a lot different. People forget that our largest embassy in the world is Jakarta. It has been for quite a while. People forget the size of our diplomatic presence in the region, so we do put a focus there. In the Pacific, likewise. I think in general, I've never been attracted to the notion that we punch above our weight. I've always felt that's been a very lazy presentation of our pursuit of our own national interests internationally. I've always taken the view, and what I've often said to graduate trainees in the public service, there are 193 countries that make up the United Nations. We have a bigger land area than all but five of them. We have a bigger population than about 140 of them. We tend to think of ourselves as of being small in population. Well, relative to China, India, the United States and Indonesia, yes, but the vast majority of countries on this planet have a smaller population than our own. We have 13th, 14th largest economy in the world. We have the 13th or 14th largest defence budget in the world in absolute terms. We're not big as per the first half dozen or so, but we are pretty big relative to most. And I think when you think in terms of punching above your weight, you're really saying there's no more you can do. You're really doing everything that should be expected of you, and no one should look in our direction. Whereas I think we should be asking ourselves whether we punch up to our weight.
You mentioned China, and we often observe here that there's a bipolar debate in Australia on China, where if you go to Canberra and you talk to the security agencies, you'll find a lot of anxiety about China's intentions, about their ambitions around their coastlines, about their attempts to coerce their neighbours and so on. But if you walk around the top end of town in a country like, in a city like Sydney, you'll often find people who scratch their heads at decisions on foreign investment or and so on, and sometimes are quite anxious about the pro-American cast of Australian foreign policy. So how would you characterise China under President Xi? Are you concerned about China's trajectory? Is this where would you place yourself in this in that debate that I sketched out?
I simply take a very simple view. What is Caesar's, and what is whatever? Just do that. The economic relationship with China, fully supportive of it. I've been involved in different areas in seeking to build a relationship with China, including in the defence arena. I see no contradiction between that and being critical of China in respect of the South China Sea, in looking to China to do more in respect of North Korea, and making the observation that China does conduct intelligence activities against us. And I've said that's no reason for us to engage in panic-driven anti-Chinese decision-making, but it's something we ought to be aware of and conscious of. Our relationship with China is always going to be more complex than our relationship with the United States. Apart from New Zealand, I think we have the most complete relationship with the United States and what we have with any country in the world. When you look at all the different elements of that relationship, we won't get there with China. There are too many differences. But nonetheless, we do have a national interest in seeking to build the relationship with China and seeking to identify areas where there might be, where we can improve mutual trust.
Let me pull out a couple of the examples you mentioned, the South China Sea and Chinese operations in Australia. First of all, on the South China Sea, you were asked earlier in the year about whether Australia should carry out a naval freedom of navigation operation. And you responded, I think at some point we should. What that point is, being a good old public servant, I'll leave it to the government. But let me try to draw you out a bit more a couple of months on. When is the point that Australia should carry out a FONOP, and what kind of advice would you give the government about the kind of operation that it should be? Is it something we should do by ourselves, with an alliance partner, with other sorts of countries?
Well, one, if you do it, you do it by yourself. Secondly, you don't single it in advance. You simply do it. Thirdly, you need to be clear what you're talking about here. There are a range of islands in the South China Sea, which under the law of the sea, project territorial seas. And we have always respected the 12 nautical miles around those islands on the grounds that we do not take a position on whose they are, but they do belong to someone. Therefore, we will respect the 12 nautical miles. I think continuing with that position is perfectly reasonable. However, there are features in the South China Sea which the Chinese have built up and created artificial structures. And those artificial A nation cannot create artificial structures which then project territorial seas. For instance, when you fly into Singapore, each time you fly into Singapore, you see that Singapore has grown still further. However, Singapore's 12 nautical miles territorial sea limit still starts from the original spot. You can't create 12 nautical miles by creating an artificial edifice in the sea. I think we should have no hesitation in sailing within 12 nautical miles of such features, because by any reading of the law of the sea, you can legitimately sail within 12 nautical miles of those features, and we should do so as a matter of course.
Has Canberra been too timid in not ordering operations like that?
Oh, look, I'd make no... I haven't left the public service to all of a sudden discover all the wisdom that I didn't have when I was in government.
I'm just letting the silence continue in case you change your mind. Let me ask you one more question about China, and then I'm going to go to the audience and give them an opportunity to see if they can break down the wall of Dennis Richardson. Chinese operations in Australia. You mentioned, and you've spoken before about Chinese intelligence operations, and of course China's not alone in conducting those, although some people argue that they're at a more intense level than other countries engage in. And certainly in the last 12 months, we've seen a lot of evidence emerging that elements that are close in some way to the Chinese Communist Party are prepared to use their financial largesse to move the Australian debate and perhaps Australian policy in directions that would be congenial to Beijing, whether it's through Chinese language media or political donations or whatever. How much of a threat to Australia's sovereignty are these efforts on your part, and are we responding to them adequately?
I think the fact that we openly discuss them, the fact they've been highlighted, I think is itself its own protective mechanism within a liberal democracy. We aren't in denial, we're aware of them, and we're open about them. So I think we're on the right track on that one.
Okay. So let me give the audience an opportunity to ask questions. I've got others, but I want to let other people have a crack first. Can I ask you to wait until the microphone comes? Can I ask you to mention your name and any affiliation, and then keep it to a brief question if you can, so we can fit in as many as possible? First hand I saw was down the back. Down the back, Andrea. Gentleman in the tie there, yes.
Ken Baxter, no affiliation, but past advisor in PNG and past head of premiers here. We have probably seen the worst election in PNG since it got independence, and a serious collapse in civil society, but with the APEC conference about to be held in PNG next year. Two questions. One, should we have greater concern about what's happening in PNG? And secondly, are we likely to pick up the tab and run the APEC conference if it doesn't be run by the Papua New Guinean government?
In respect of the latter, we'll most certainly help PNG in every way we can in respect of APEC. And I suspect closer to the time it may involve putting in more resources. But I think if we need to do that, and if PNG want us to do it, we will. Yes, we should be concerned about developments in Papua New Guinea. I think within government circles, I think that is well understood. I think within the broader, it gets a certain amount of play in the broader community, but I think many Australians, I think, still have an impression of Papua New Guinea that goes back 40 years. Most Australians are surprised when you tell them that, yes, we do give some hundreds of millions a year in development assistance to Papua New Guinea, but that now constitutes only about 7% of PNG's budget. Our capacity to influence in PNG is significantly less than what most Australians think. Therefore, how we re-engage psychologically on that, bearing in mind you look ahead to 2050, PNG will have a population of around what Australia's is today, and I don't think we've fully thought through the implications of all of that.
Let me go to Dick Walcott and then Professor James Curran. Dick, if you could just wait for the mic.
It's unfair to have a former boss ask me a question.
That's how we roll at the Lowy Institute, Dennis.
Dick Walcott, who worked with Dennis for a long time in Canberra. Dennis, I've taken a lot of notes of what you said, and I'd like to, but I'll try and put it down to one particular question, and that is that despite the continuing widening of the Australian population beyond the essentially Anglo-Saxon, Anglo-Celtic element, why are our coalition ALP leaders so focused now on what I'd call Islamophobia, Russophobia, and Chinaphobia? Now, I only know personally two Muslims in Sydney, but they are both shocked by the hatred they say they encounter virtually every other day. Now, Yasmin Abdel Magid, who has been in this country since she was two, but has now left. And she left because she said she felt she'd been driven out of living in Australia by the hatred of non-white women wearing scarves. Now, to what extent are we allowing ourselves to become a racist country in these terms?
Well, personally, I don't believe we are. It is very difficult to if you're engaged in counterterrorism activities, and the vast majority of your targets reside in a particular community broadly defined, it is extremely difficult to target those individuals without the community as a whole feeling that they're being targeted. I think Australian agencies do their very best to avoid that. I think governments are conscious of it. And I personally know people who have been affected by anti-Islamic attitudes, but I do not believe as a community as a whole we are racist. In terms of Russia, I suspect that doesn't touch most people directly, but Russia's attempts to engage in activity relating to the US election and also what they've done in Western Europe ought to concern us all.
That's exactly what the United States
does. I'm not aware of the United States having attempted to engage in activity in Australia of a kind that Russia has engaged in the US.
The United States
has removed governments. In some cases.
All right, James Curran.
Dennis, James Curran from Sydney Uni and Lowy. I just want to take you back to, I think, the conclusion of your National Press Club speech, where you talked about the need for governments in the future to remake the case for the alliance to millennials, for the US alliance. And one of the things you said was that it would need a little bit of history to connect past and present. And I wondered if you had a view, is there a sense in which over the last decade we've overdone the history to the point where we forget about those moments that you mentioned earlier in your conversation with Michael, where Australian governments have been, of both political persuasions, have been hard-headed in defence of the Australian national interest, and that we haven't always lined up behind the Americans? Or is this the way to handle Trump at the moment, smother him in history and leave the substance, the operational substance of the alliance, to the serious professionals?
Look, I think it's important for us to talk about the Australia-US relationship as a relationship, as opposed to simply the alliance. The alliance is a central part of the relationship, and as I said in answer to a question from Michael, I think our relationship with the United States is probably more complete than our relationship with any other country, with the possible exception of New Zealand. I know we have a constitutional link with the UK, which we don't have, or when I say with the UK, they gratuitously share a head of state with us. We don't have that link with the US. But whether it be scientific research, whether it be medical research, whether it be space activities, whether it be financial flows, economic, you name it. I can't think of another country with who we have a more complete relationship than the US. And I think we need to talk about the breadth and depth of that relationship rather than singularly focus, as we often do, on the alliance. We should talk about the alliance, but it's important that we don't become monofocused.
Let me pick you up on one aside you made there about the Brits gratuitously sharing their head of state with us. We found out last week, we were reminded last week, that it's unacceptable for a senator to have dual citizenship, but of course it's completely acceptable for our head of state to be a foreigner. Do you think if Australia were to become a republic, by which I mean have a situation where every office under our constitution was held by Australians, including the highest office, in other words, where our head of state was an Australian, how would that change Australians' approach to themselves and to the world, do you think?
Interesting point. I think it would marginally help in terms of the way we present ourselves. I think it is a little bit odd when you drink a toast to the Queen and people of Australia. And please, I mean no disrespect to the Queen. I mean that genuinely because, one, I don't know her. Secondly, I have met her on a number of occasions, not substantively, and anyone who has can be nothing but full of admiration for her as an individual. She's one of the great figures of the last half century or so. So I don't mean any of this disrespectfully, and I think you've got to be able to have this discussion as you want to, Michael, and put to one side the individual. I think it would boost our own sense of self. I think it would boost the way others see us. It's marginal. It's not going to radically change things. I even go one step further, which is quite controversial. I would have a flag which wasn't a quarter of the Union Jack. And please don't get me wrong, I don't mind having the Union Jack on the flag, and indeed the flag of the state of Hawaii in the United States has the Union Jack on it. I mean, it is part of our history, and if that was considered appropriate to have, wouldn't worry me at all. But I think when you see our flag, it does hit you. That does. And I think of the Canadians who, Maple Leaf, they, interestingly, they need the monarchy because they've got Quebec. So I can't see Canada becoming a republic anytime soon. But in changing the great symbol of their country, They have, I think, done something in terms of appearance and presentation, which we've been unable to do. Even though I've got to say, I think we're talking here around the margins. Yeah. We're not talking fundamentally.
My own, of course, the Lowy Institute has no opinion on these issues, but my own two cents is that Canada, one of the reasons it worked for Canada is they got such a great design. And a lot of the flags that are often suggested for Australia with kangaroos and so on don't make it. On the other hand, I'm always reminded of how Jerry Seinfeld described the Australian flag, Britain at night. But let me move on. Let me move.
And of course, New Zealand voted to keep their flag. So I mean,
there you go.
You know, I mean,
let me move on from that. I'm not picking on a British national by going to Ewan Graham after that discussion. But let me go to Ewan Graham, whom I saw next, and then Meriden, whom I saw after that. Ewan Graham, our head of international security.
Thanks, Dennis. I'll keep the flag out of my question. Setting aside the people who make up our defence establishment, how would you define the most important capability, defence capability for Australia, and why?
Yeah. Well, it's people, as you said. I don't know whether you can. The way capabilities are now interconnected, I don't think you could pick out a single capability and say that is central. It is, if there's any capability that is now central, it's your capability to connect your Air Force with your Army, with your Navy. It's your connectivity and the way you can bring the different individual capabilities together for the biggest effect.
Just following up on that, I mean, one of the issues that Ewan writes often about is North Korea, and there's been a lot of discussion in the last few months about North Korea's programs, and in the last couple of weeks about how Australia should react to that, and in particular, should we invest in particular capabilities? How do you think, what else should Australia be thinking about in relation to North Korea? What else can we do, do you think, to protect our interests and our security and contribute to the resolution of the issue?
I don't know whether there's a lot we can do. I do strongly believe there is more China can do. I was at Dandong on the border of China and North Korea last October, and anyone who is there for any length of time, seeing the unbroken movement of trucks from China into transports from China into North Korea. And when there was a report in the Financial Review last week that trade between China and North Korea had increased 10% over the last 12 months or so. But I don't think China will do any more in respect of North Korea until it believes the downside for them outweighs the upside of having North Korea there. I think there are the elements of a long-term resolution, but I think we have a long way to go before we get there, and we would need to envisage probably a permanently separated Korea, and we would need to envisage some other elements. But none of that counts for anything until China comes to a view that the path down which North Korea is heading will ultimately be to China's politico-strategic disadvantage.
And what about from Australia's own perspective? Obviously, the range of North Korean missiles is increasing. Yeah. The rhetoric continues. Yeah. How worried should we be about that from a selfish point of view?
Well, I think before we get there, what would happen if President Trump's nationalist approach became embedded in US foreign and strategic policy, and what would happen if US administrations started to return to the rhetoric of President Trump during the election campaign, which I don't think would happen, but if it did, would that lead to Japan deciding that it needed its own nuclear weapons? And how would that change the political strategic equation in China? What will other countries such as Indonesia do? What do you do in the face of a country acquiring accurate missiles on which they can put nuclear weapons when the regime that is doing that has no hesitation in showing on their own national TV nuclear explosions over Washington and other countries? What do you do in the face of that? Sitting around holding hands saying pa pa doesn't take you very far. Sooner or later, something will have to give. And I think, but I don't think it will give until China comes to terms with where the region is heading because of North Korea.
You were talking then about scenarios in which Asian allies of the United States started to doubt the credibility of the US nuclear umbrella and taking matters into their own hands. Could you ever envisage circumstances in which Australia would seek to acquire a nuclear deterrent?
Well, you can always develop artificial scenarios in which you could do that, but I think within the foreseeable future, no.
Let me go to Meriden Verrell at the back.
Thanks. I just wanted to ask if you had, since we're sort of talking about China and the way in which it operates, if you had any thoughts about the debate that we've seen in Australia over recent months about the extradition treaty and whether or not Australia should comply with China's requests on that one.
Oh, I was disappointed to see the treaty go down the drain, but I understood why it did.
I'm Jim Demings. Dennis, my question is more domestic, and one of the features of Australia's democracy, the strength of our democracy, is the division of the political, bureaucratic and judicial. Could you tell us a little more about how, and you've had a number of positions heading significant public service departments, the degree to which, and say going back when you took over defence, when you were appointed to defence, the degree to which those decisions are made at the political level or at the bureaucratic level? Is there significant influence in the appointment of a department secretary, not the final decision, but in determining who will be the head of the department?
A departmental secretary is appointed by the Prime Minister, not by the Minister. That's in legislation and the like. It is legitimate for an elected government to bring to bear whatever considerations they wish. A Prime Minister in appointing a secretary will normally consult with his or her relevant ministers and normally receives advice from the head of Prime Minister and Cabinet and the Public Service Commissioner. However, it is for the Prime Minister to make the decision, and I've got no problem with that. We sometimes tend to have a glossy view of the past, I once saw a political assessment of heads of departments quite some years ago, and when I saw that, which was by accident, it was at a time when it was at a time which we now refer back to as a period when there was no political interference. We do need to keep our feet on the ground on issues of that kind.
Ingrid Selene, I wanted to ask you about cybersecurity and cyber warfare, and to what extent you saw that as a risk for Australia, and perhaps what advice you'd be giving of extra steps we should be taking to mitigate those risks, or are we doing enough already?
Look, I'm not an expert in that area. You're right to highlight as a risk. It will be a growing risk, but I think I won't make a judgment about what we should be doing, because quite frankly, anyone who knows me would roll on the floor laughing if I was to give advice about what we should be doing in the cyber area. Last week, for the first time in my life, I sent an email.
The good news is that probably makes you safe from cyber hacking. I'm going to take the last question from a Lowy Institute staff member, Aaron Connolly.
Thanks, Michael. Dennis, I was wondering if you could speak a little bit about how you see U.S. foreign policy institutions coping with the Trump presidency and the broader phenomenon of American populism. Do you think that they will be able to defend some of the important things that they care about against those in the White House who have a more populist view of American interests? Or do you think that the president is the president and ultimately his views will overcome any objections from within the U.S. system?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. First of all, I think Bob Carr has raised the question of whether President Trump's election constitutes a watershed in U.S. attitudes towards the world and also its domestic politics, and whether Trump will simply be the first of a series of people with an outlook similar to President Trump's. I think that's an open question, and I don't go there at this point. I think, sit back and be a bit more patient. Secondly, I think one does need to distinguish between what Trump says and what he does. I know a lot of people say that, but I think it is true. Thirdly, far too many people go back and highlight what President Trump said during the election campaign. The fact that he's not followed through on so many things he said during the election campaign is something we ought to welcome, not be critical of. It is disappointing that the TPP is down and out. Even more disappointing that someone like Hillary Clinton, who was a strong advocate of it, turned away from it. And if you can see what Hillary Clinton did in respect of the TPP, then you can start to understand why President Trump took the approach he did in respect of the TPP. The last thing I would say is this, and that is one of the difficulties we're facing globally at the moment is the fact that there is inevitably tension between countries that are overly nationalistic and global leadership. Global leadership invariably involves some compromise in terms of strident nationalism. And at the moment, we have a few too many examples in a few too many big countries at the moment of strident nationalism. So when people talk about global leadership, and they talk about a global leadership passing from, say, the United States to China, you won't see a passing of global leadership like that for a whole variety of reasons. My own personal view is that China is not capable of global leadership. So I think what you will see is an absence of global leadership of a kind which, to some extent, we had become accustomed to for 70-odd years. And you will see a diffusion of leadership that will be issue dependent and the like, and where it's simply different to the world in which we've grown up. People talk about it becoming more complex and all of this. I think all of that's rubbish. I mean, try telling anyone who led a country during the Second World War that the world's becoming more complex, and they'd probably laugh at you. But I think, unfortunately, people don't live long enough. So we don't have a Gladstone, we don't have a Disraeli, we don't have a Bismarck to go back and talk to see what it was like. So we have to relearn everything again. And how well we learn it, who knows?
Well, I think we've all had a masterclass today. We don't have a Bismarck or Disraeli with us, but we do have Richardson with us, and we've benefited from that. In fact, I think we've all seen evidence of why Dennis had such a storied career, a mix of long experience, a broad worldview, a beguiling mix of frankness and circumspection, an excellent earthy Australian sense of humour, and a lot of wisdom. So, Dennis, you've long been a friend of the Institute, and you've spoken to us on many occasions. We hope we may get to see you more, and we thank you on behalf of everybody. Let me thank you very much for participating in this conversation. Thank you. One final advertisement, ladies and gentlemen. We have a very impactful and influential politician, world leader, speaking to the Institute next Thursday night, Boris Johnson, the British Foreign Secretary, at the annual Lowy Lecture. Tickets have been selling like hotcakes. It's going to be a terrific event. There are still a few left. I know some people here will be coming, but if you'd like to come, then please talk to my colleagues, and we hope to see some of you there. Thank you very much.
Let me put in a plug for that. You will not only get substance, you'll get good entertainment.